I'm going to try to make my comments pretty brief. I just want to speak a little bit more to that, why I'm here today. A lot of times I try to speak for people, and then today I was, I can't do that. So today I'm just going to talk about why I'm here today. One of the things that I've learned and recognized is that America has been at war for, or in armed conflicts for a long time, like I said. And the war in Iraq is just a continuation of that. And I feel responsible for supporting that war. I drove a car back and forth to here. That oil supports the war. You know, the food I buy, everything I do, my life. I'm an American citizen. I live in the empire. Some of the information I wanted to bring to you today was how far our American empire reaches as far as our military might and the way we affect people around the globe today. This is a global problem. Our country is a global problem, I believe. There are 192 countries in the world, and America has troops in 135 of those countries, in some form or another. Now, that may be just an embassy with 8 to 50 guards, but it is also the 74,000 troops in Germany, or it's the 1,700 troops in Iceland, or the 1,500 troops in Belgium, or the 3,000 troops in Bosnia and Herzegovina. You know, I pronounced that terrible. Or the supposed 180,000 to 200,000 troops in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan that we can't ever seem to talk about anymore. Those are the reasons why I'm here. I feel responsible every day, every minute, every hour for those actions that my country carries out in my name. And that's what is happening. I can't deny that. There's no way I can get around any of that. So those are the reasons why I came out today and the way I chose to speak and why I wanted to help put this thing together is so that somehow we can, make that change, make that stop, start being responsible for something different than death and war and greed and consumption of goods. Because I feel like that's pretty much what my life stands for most of the time. So with that happy note, I don't feel like this is a real celebration, unfortunately. We're celebrating death today in an odd way. So with that, I'm going to bring on our next speaker. I'm not even getting into my notes on what President Bush said the other day. Good for the people of Iraq, good for America. That's his idea of war. It's good for the people of Iraq, and it's good for America, and it's good for the world, he said. It's our elected or appointed official. So with that, thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to bring up Nick Geyer, and he's going to speak, and we'll just kind of roll through this. I'm sure it's very obvious that I am not very formal, and I don't have anything really timed down to the minute. Thank you for your support. We're just going to let people get up and speak. I also feel like if cheer out or whatever and support. The food is there. Please consume it in the best way that you can. It's vegan for those people who don't, that consider that. It's organic. There's a salad. There's dressing. There's bread. And with that, we'll bring on Nick. Thank you, Nick.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Sally for inviting me to speak. I guess maybe I invited myself to speak, but I'm happy to be here. Maybe some of you have seen The Weeknd's Doonesbury. I wanted to go through it for those who haven't, and it's great to go through two or three times. It is a dialogue between Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. Son, do you know why I decided not to invade Iraq? Haven't a clue, Dad. Really, I put it in my book. Books are Laura's things. Let me read you a few excerpts. An occupation of Iraq would have incurred incalculable human and political costs. There was no viable exit strategy. Had we gone the invasion route, the United States could conceivably still be an occupying power in a bitterly hostile land. I don't recall any of that, Dad. But it was reported in all the papers. I don't read newspapers. My favorite line, another child left behind. Nice to talk to you, son. Listen, Dad, you're either with me or against me. I felt like tearing up my talk after seeing that this morning. Let me begin with an observation that has been made before, but it is worth repeating. In the aftermath of September 11th, most of the people of the world united in support of our great loss. A major French newspaper ran a huge headline that proclaimed that we are now all Americans. It was the most goodwill shown to our country since the liberation of Europe in 1945. A wise U.S. president would have capitalized on that goodwill and would have built a worldwide coalition to prevent future terrorist attacks. But instead, our president refused to focus on the terrorists themselves and invaded Iraq. When our European allies refused to support us, Bush turned on them and all others who dared challenge his war plans. Within a period of 16 months, President Bush had totally destroyed all that goodwill by slamming the UN and implying that the Germans and the French were cowards. Freedom fries were not the worst for me. As a longtime accordion player, the following insult really got to me. Going to war without France is like going deer hunting without your accordion. Every single reason that Bush gave for going to war has now found to be misleading or totally inaccurate. You can call them lies if you want to. A Democratic staff report of the House Intelligence Committee now has compiled a list of 273 Bush administration deceptions. Let's take a look at some of these, and I'll update some of the new facts that have arisen. The worst deception of all is the conflation of the war on terrorism with the invasion of Iraq. Even when Bush denied that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and September 11th, 70% of American people, forever gullible and ignorant, I'm afraid, still told pollsters that they thought there was a link. As a retired philosophy professor, I thought I'd make up a little jingoistic syllogism. It goes something like this. First premise, Saddam bad. Second premise, Osama, he's bad too. Third premise, 9/11, that was bad. Therefore, you can logically connect them all. They're all bad and they're logically connected. Maybe these Americans were listening too much to Vice President Cheney, who continued to repeat that there was a link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, and still believes that WMDs will be found. Now, George Tenet says that he's trying to correct the Bush administration on these pronouncements. It doesn't seem like he's succeeding. The CIA has a complaint board that the employees can put their complaints on anonymously. By far, the most postings on this complaint board have to do with Bush administration officials linking Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. There was a group of terrorists in northeast Iraq. The name of the group is Ansar al-Islam, and they were outside of Saddam Hussein's jurisdiction. He had no control over them. But nonetheless, the administration tried to link that group with Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. I read a report from a Boston Globe reporter. In fact, it wasn't a report. It was a live report from Iraq on NPR. The reporter was there with his Iraqi interpreter. Documents were flying in the air after the Kurdish and U.S. troops had come through the area. They spent several days looking at the documents. Not a single document linked that group with Saddam Hussein. In fact, this group is only loosely linked with al-Qaeda. In fact, a report said that Ansar al-Islam had asked for support from al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda had rejected that support. We're hearing again about the Jordanian terrorist. His name is al-Sarqawi. We have linked him with Saddam and also with al-Qaeda. But the most definite link that we have with this terrorist and his financial support is a member of the royal Qatar family. If you'll remember, Qatar was our base of support before we moved into. That's where the central command, I think, still is with their basic communications. Why didn't we go after that fellow? And think of the thousands of documents that we've poured over since the invasion. It's a year now. Not a single document has linked Saddam Hussein with the terrorists who attacked the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. When the UN inspectors left Iraq in 1998, they destroyed completely every nuclear capacity that they could find in Iraq. There was nothing left as far as they were concerned. But in September of 2002, the Bush administration said that Saddam could have nukes ready in 6 months. Remember Condoleezza Rice's wonderful image, the smoking gun may be a mushroom cloud. And at that time, they used a report from the International Atomic Energy Association, or Commission, or whatever it's called. It turned out that document did not exist. It was a total falsification. And we've now discovered, of course, he had no nukes. Remember the Niger uranium deception. Cheney sent Joseph Wilson to Niger to ferret this out. He found no support for the connection between Iraq and Niger. Still, the Bush administration kept pushing that deception and kept making a false point. Recently, the British were pushed to reveal their sources of information. Remember what happened? The CIA managed to get that out of a speech that Bush made in Cincinnati in October of 2002, but it creeped back in the State of the Union message of 2003. The CIA objected, but the Bush administration said, could we leave it in if we attribute it to the British? And they said, okay, go ahead. The British have been pressed about their sources for this. Their sources are just as fraudulent as the original Italian sources. Remember the aluminum tubes that Saddam Hussein was going to use to make uranium-235. Early on, experts said the tubes were too thick. They were most likely to be used for rocket launchers. The experts now have been vindicated. Remember the mobile labs that were supposed to disperse biological weapons. Both the State Department, their intelligence, and the Defense Intelligence Agency both said early on that they were not biological weapon mobile labs. We now know, after looking at them very closely, they were used to blow up helium balloons for weather surveys. Many members of Congress were really impressed and scared out of their wits by reports that the Bush administration made available that Saddam Hussein would deliver WMDs from drones flying up and down the Atlantic coast. Air Force intelligence before the invasion discounted such a capacity on the part of Saddam Hussein. Now we've had a chance to look at all those drones. They are essentially glorified model airplanes, some of them with a wingspan of 24 feet. The payload is very small, probably a camera and a VCR. They were not weapons of any sort. One of the most irritating things that I find that I hear from my senator when I call his assistant, and we've heard this phrase so many times, it's better to fight the terrorists in Baghdad than to fight them in Detroit. This reminds me of the Cold War. Remember, and both the Soviet Union and us were guilty of this. We fought the Cold War in third world countries, right? Millions of people in third world countries died because of the Cold War. We'd rather fight them there and kill innocent third world people rather than to take the casualties ourselves. I think this is an incredibly cynical rationale that seems to be playing very well. Better to fight them in Baghdad than in Detroit. What I say is bring the troops home. We can save billions of dollars. We need to be more secure in our homeland. The ports and their cargo is still unprotected. Air cargo is still unprotected. Homeland security should have been fully funded according to Joe Lieberman's initial proposal on this. Remember, Bush rejected the idea of homeland security early on because it was a Democratic idea. Think of the billions of dollars we could save to make our country safe, and we would have billions of dollars left over for health care and education. Thank you.
All right, watch out for the pink ribbons. Okay, just a little information for y'all to keep you up to date. For people that walked in, there's food. I just want to keep reminding people about the food. We're going to have one more speaker added in, and she's going to be in the middle with Linda, very good speaker. Molly Karp is going to speak. And then next is Hesu Estrada, and she's going to be covering war and poverty a little bit, and she's going to speak some poetry. And I'd like to please encourage everybody to stick around and try and stay and listen to each of the people that are going to speak today, because I think they're really going to all hit really different areas. There's a lot of different opinions that are going to come up before you, and a lot of different stories and presentations. So I'm going to encourage everybody to stick around. All right, thank you.
Are you guys doing all right? Can you guys hear me back there? I want to give you a warm welcome from the League of from the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, from Poland and all over the country. On behalf of all of us who have a vision of a human and just world, I want to thank you for letting me speak to you today. And if you can't hear me while I'm speaking, just raise your hand and I'll pipe up. I'm here to talk about a different kind of war, the war on the poor and working classes of America. Recently, that murdering corporate puppet, Bush, was lying, talking about the rise in employment, talking about how the economy was doing better. Most of y'all know that that's bullshit, right? But what he didn't talk about was that a lot of these jobs were part-time without health benefits. He didn't talk about the millions of poor, the growing gap between the rich and the poor. The Census Bureau is pretty conservative, and what it's estimating is that there's 34.5 million people in poverty right now in this land of great wealth. Bush didn't talk about how so many middle-class people are trickling down to the poor class. He didn't talk about how median household incomes keep dropping every year. He didn't talk about the 2.1 million immigrant children without health care. Think about that, healthcare, no healthcare. And I was thinking the other day, nothing against dogs, but there are dogs in this country with better healthcare, food, shelter. Dogs even get to go to school, you know? And think about how in this country, they're privatizing grade school, privatizing universities, tuition rates are increasing at ridiculous rates. At some point, there's gonna be more dogs than people going to school, you know? I mean, it's ridiculous. And we've all heard, I've been hearing this for a while now, but the threats on Social Security and Medicare, more recently by Greenspan, was talking about decimating Social Security and Medicare. I saw an estimate last summer that they were thinking of cutting $400 billion in the next 10 years in Social Security. Now think about what that's going to mean for future generations, for pregnant mothers, for the unemployed, for all of us. I want to read a poem and really think about, what's causing all this inhumanity. And this poem is by Jack Hirschman. If you guys know Jack Hirschman, he's a fellow revolutionary from the Bay Area. And he wrote this poem around the time of September 11th called Weapon of Mass Destruction. Weapon of Mass Destruction by Jack Hirschman. For almost 20 years, these streets have been home to the victims. And there have been more each year of the horrible weapon, use of the weapon of mass destruction that has grown more evil each succeeding year. Surely you know it. Look at the sidewalk and the ravaged body on it. Look in that doorway where your brother or sister is curled up in pain. How many God bless yous have followed you home? How many thank yous? You're a veteran of all this by now. a street person who seems so many disappeared, murdering each other. The silence, the great silence of shame under all words, all noises, turns in on itself, is itself lost, no longer get edible. Might as well be dead. Who has lived knowing the weapon of mass destruction intimately, precisely, as a dirty tip of a boot that looks you in the eye when you wake in the morning in some shelter, anywhere you can get to? Oh, weapon of mass destruction, we've inspected you all our lives and find you everywhere, capitalism, and want you irrevocably dead. I think there's a growing discontentment in this country, and we see this with people who hold up signs saying books, not bombs, employment, the need for a socialized healthcare. This capitalism that is spinning out of control and taking the most vulnerable with it, whether it's the illegal alien who's been gunned down by vigilantes, confused racist patriots who are blaming the wrong people for unemployment, or whether it's the thousands of unemployed people who've lost jobs through automation and technology, like in Detroit, Michigan, and Flint, Michigan. And you may have heard about these studies that are going on, but there are people who are actually thinking about automating packing houses in the state of Washington, robots that are going to pick fruit. And I think about that, what that will mean to workers, because it's so much easier to maintain a robot than to give health benefits to workers. That's, I think, what the logic of the capitalists are. And now, I thought, you know, I had my, this is my very first shirt I got from San Francisco, and it says fuck Bush. Now, although I agree, and I really do, I agree that beating Bush is critical. Whether we have a president who uses different tactics or does these moves towards empire and destruction with the UN approval, it doesn't make much of a difference to me. This war against the poor needs to stop. It needs to stop. Gives me so mad. But you know, presidents, regardless of parties, have always played into the hands of the ruling class, those bigot billionaires who think they've earned their wealth. And they do this by repression, by exploitation, through bombs. We need to start imagining something different, something new that will meet the needs of the most hurt in this country, of the poor, of working classes, of pregnant mothers, of all of us. And I don't want to leave you on a down note, because I know this administration does a fine job of trying to kill hope. I want to read you a work in progress. And it's called Esperanza, which is hope in Spanish. There's an epigraph here by a revolutionary woman, a mortal woman from the Philippines. And she says, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it." So Esperanza. And it's a work in progress. So, yeah. "It is not the system that eats broken street children, not made in America bullets that kill brown-faced angels, not the sweat-soaked worker chasing the red, white, and blue dream. It is not the old woman in Pullman splitting heart pills to live another lonely day. It is not the fucked upness of homelessness, hunger, violence, racism, and war. The fucked upness of a consuming capitalism that eats people, chews earth, sucks in the sky. No, but I can feel it coming. A warm sunshine through murderous monsoons. Sunshine that renews abundance to feed all humanity. Birth in uncomatose minds that have torn down money-making walls like the ones at U of I. Minds with an unbound vision of life. Eyes that meet, stop, and are strangers no more. Eyes that love something deep, deeper than a mother holding a newborn child. I can feel it coming. The breath of the intangible that refuses to die. Breath through mouths that demand food. Breath through mouths that speak truth. Breath through millions of miles filling the world with justice. The intangible that almost breathed our America. The intangible dreamed through the ages, made flesh in all of us." Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Hesu, and thank you, Nick. Those are both fine talks, speeches, if you want to be formal about it. All right, next will be Rich Weckerly. He's going to come up and speak, I think, about his experiences again in Georgia at the School of Americas. I'm not sure how to fill you in too much more without really getting into a lot of it. It's a school where people are trained military style, police style. A lot of our police officers, the ones that have been driving by,
maybe not from Moscow, but American police officers go there to learn tactics about interrogation and whatnot. A lot of military forces go there. Some people say Bin Laden was trained there. And there's a lot of Americans that go there all the time and protest this school and cross what they call a line. And when they cross that line, they go to jail. And that's democracy in America. Excuse me. One of the things, just my little quick note in between, is I'd like to remind everybody that not only are we sitting here doing this today, but around the world today, there are people recognizing that what's going on in Iraq. There are millions of people in the United States that are protesting today and have been protesting. There are millions of people in the world that are protesting today in different countries, in Italy, and all over the place. And there is a lot more opposition to this war than maybe us that live in the heart of the empire recognize on a daily basis. Because when you live in the heart of the empire, we are we are suppressed. So it can be very hard to, you know, see all those things that are going on in the world and that people are against this war. All right, so with the American Empire, let's look at it in a different facet. Let's bring up Rich Weckerly here.
Rich, watch out for the paint.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for having me. Like was just said, the School of the Americas is a school located at Fort Benning, Georgia. It's been there for about 20 years, and about 20 years before that, it was in Panama. The School of the Americas, what they do is train South American military personnel, which in many cases have over the past years gone back and oppressed and murdered and killed their own people.
Try sticking to a little more. I have the same problem. Mm-hmm.
The demonstrations were started by a Mary Knoll priest who had been working in Bolivia. He was finally asked to leave Bolivia. Actually, he was thrown out of Bolivia, came back, and in 1989, he started the demonstration at Fort Benning. At that time, there were about 20 people showed up for these demonstrations, and half of them were arrested and sent to jail, actually, because you're not supposed to be on a military base and politically protest the actions of the military. Well, that was in 1989. I got involved in it around 1995. Actually, just hearing about the school, because I had worked in several years in Africa with my wife, and we kind of know what it's like living in countries that where the people are basically oppressed. We were working in Sierra Leone, West Africa. So we came back, we kind of, when we saw the different articles in the paper or different news releases about the School of the Americas, we got involved in the issue. And in 1998, I went down there and got involved with the protest. At that time, there were 10,000 people would show up every November to protest the school. Now we're up to about 15,000 people that show up to protest the existence of the school. Amnesty International, today 105 representatives in Congress are calling for an investigation of this very controversial school. I crossed the line in the year 2000 and got arrested and was given a ban and bar letter, which means not to return for 5 years. This past November, I crossed the line again with 27 others, and we were all arrested. Thank you. We spent 2 days in Muskegee County Jail. And I got to say, the people I spent time in jail with, there were five priests, there were three missionaries, there was a theologian, there was a retired college professor. So I spent some time in jail with some wonderful, wonderful people. I just got a letter the other day. Now, I had the ability to self-report, meaning I was found guilty at trial. I had the ability to self-report, and I just got a letter the other day. I'm to report to federal penitentiary in Oregon to start my sentence of 6 months, which will be April 6th. That's how I got involved in it. But And I know most of you don't know too much about the School of the Americas. It's not my, I'm not up here to talk so much about the school. I can do that any time. I've done that many times in the past. What I'd like to talk a little bit about is commitment. Many people ask me, you're going away to jail for 6 months. I'm retired. I live here with my wife, Dana. That's going to be very difficult, but what are you accomplishing? Are you going to close the School of the Americas by your going to jail? Don't you think that's a little radical on your part to do that? Well, I've done a lot of things. I've spoken about this issue. I've written letters about this issue. I've participated in the demonstrations every year since 1998. I feel I'm called to do this now. I'm called to do this now. And in a sense, we're all called to do something. When we see things like the war in Iraq, we see what's happening in the rest of the world, we see the way we are oppressing people in Latin America, we are called to do something. I've been involved with this issue for lots of years, so I feel I'm being called to do this here now. Like we're all being called to do something. We're being called today to stand here in Friendship Square and protest the school, not only the School of the Americas, of course, but the war in Iraq and what's happening in the world. And some of us need to look at ourselves and say, what else am I being called to do? Can I spend some time and write a letter? Can I speak about the issue? Can I speak out about the need that we seem to have for war with my friends and with others? We all need to stand up, because what I'm doing and what we're doing here this morning is not going to change their minds in Washington, D.C. Not at all. But we may change some other folks' minds here in Moscow about what our country is doing. So I want you all really to think about what's happening in our country. And if you think about it long enough and hard enough, I'm sure you're going to come away and say, I need to do something better. I mean, lots of times people look at us as being less than patriotic. I think we're being more than patriotic. We want to get our country back on the right footing. So thank you very much.
All right. Outstanding. Yeah, I know some folks that have been to jail for crossing the line as well. And that can be a difficult thing. And the commitment that Rich is talking about is carried out a lot in this country. And a lot of times it's portrayed in a really negative sense. One of the biggest examples I can think of is Miami recently. There was a lot of young people that it may have been not worth anything, and it may have been haphazard and unworthwhile, but they went ahead and went to Miami and showed up and protested. And after the 30,000 union workers were done in their march, they went ahead and stayed, and they ended up getting in large conflicts with the police, as many of you know. Not all of them their faults, some of them their fault. And a lot of them went to jail, and a lot of people got hurt. And that, to me, is, as well, commitment. Our next speaker is Molly Karp. She's going to speak next. I don't know what Molly's speaking about. So she'll be coming up, and that's a person that, in my opinion, also has a great deal of commitment to changing the way we live, as many of you do, as I don't know you as well personally. So showing up here is as well part of commitment to changing things. All right, Molly, please come on up. And thanks for everybody speaking before.
What's up? This thing's a little tall, but... it's not that important. Alright, this morning I had a pretty epiphanous moment. As we all talk about how Bush lied, the CIA lied, gaps in intelligence, and all that stuff, like, I was thinking, like, who's shocked? I'm not shocked. Empires lie. What's the big deal, right? So they didn't lie. I'm gonna do a little Bushism here and say they transcended reality, and I can swallow that a little bit better. And I guess what gets me is that people, I think, are approaching this war as an anomaly, or something that's happening in this really messed up vacuum at this junction in history. And I think that's really incorrect, and I think we're taking it out of historical context. I think we only need to look at the Ottoman Empire to realize it's about oil, it's about resource. Empire's been fighting over resources for years, and we're just the biggest player in this game. So I don't think it's a new war, and I think that it's the same war that we fought in Vietnam. It's the same thing, because it's global capitalism, and global capitalism demands a resource. And whether that's a third world nation, or their resources, or oil, or forests, or anything, in a capitalist nation, we need a resource to be a capitalist nation. And the end result of capitalism is an empire. And that's totalitarianism, and that's fascism. And I think that we need to keep that in perspective when we're approaching things, because even if we want to bring about peace, what's peace? You can't have peace if you have an economy based on the exploitation of resources, which our economy demands. And that's why I want to say it's not a new war. And then when I think about it, I think about conspiracy theories, and then they're all floating around. Did we bomb the World Trade Towers, and who's doing what? I'd like to say, if we're really interested in conspiracies, the greatest conspiracy of them all is capitalism, because the best conspirator wins. It's the game of Monopoly. We played that growing up. And I guess what really irks me, and I think the most important thing to do, is the misuse of the English language. I think that's one of the greatest abuses that's going on, because I don't think we're that big of idiots, We don't have to follow rules as an occupying force, because we're not occupiers, we're liberators. We don't have to grant people any rights as prisoners, because they're not prisoners of war, right? They're enemy combatants. I'm not an English major, but I think it's really egregious abuse of the English language. And I think that, throughout history, we've seen people pick up weapons to fight, to fight oppression. They stormed the Bastille. They took over the Batista government in Cuba. Every day, people are picking up arms to fight their oppressors. And I think we need to reclaim the English language and speak truth to power. Thanks.
Outstanding. Thank you, Molly. As always, a very eloquent speaker. Another story that I personally believe and have heard a little bit about will be coming up next, and that's Linda Arrowsmith. And I don't know. All I can say is this is just, not only is it interesting, but it's also a pretty powerful story. And I'm just going to leave it at that. She's going to speak about how the military is affecting family and the soldiers itself, and something that we're all seeing now. The wounded are coming home, and so are the body bags. And not that that's anything real new, but it's in big quantities again. Oh, here we go. Here's Linda.
I consider myself a very lucky person. There's four men that have had a great impact on my life.
Try to scoot up.
One was my father. He was a World War II veteran. It was an unwritten rule in my house, you never ask about the war. I don't know who said it. I don't know. I don't remember anybody saying, don't say anything, but we knew it was not to be done. Another person that's had a great effect on my life is my best friend. The other two are my sons, Adam and Paul. And Adam right now is serving in the United States Air Force at Mountain Home Air Force Base. The hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life was to sign those papers for delayed entry. I'd done everything in my power to talk that boy out of it. I offered to take a second job to give him money for school. I'd done everything. And his response was, Mom, I can't have you do that for me. I have to do this myself. I won't do that to you. Then one day I had to take him to Spokane. And it was a long trip. I'd drive a while and he'd cry. He'd drive a while and I'd cry. We finally got him there, got him signed in, sworn in, I mean. And it was kind of funny. The lieutenant colonel that swore him in looked right straight at the four boys that were being sworn in. I think she looked at my son because she says, boys, it's okay if your moms cry. And the lady next to me said, well, she's already crying. And so here we go, doing the military thing. And it's pretty scary because I have boys that don't even like to spend the night away from home. And Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, Texas, is a long way from home. I've never not been able to get in touch with my boys, but I couldn't. And so pretty soon he's headed for Mississippi for advanced training, and then pretty soon Mountain Home. And we do a lot of talking, and he knows my views on what's going on and my views on the military and everything. And then last November, I went down to see him at Mountain Home. And I went down the day before Thanksgiving, and I called him when I got... I stopped at this gas station about 10 miles from the base, and I call him, and he's been sleeping, and he sounds kind of weird. And I'm going, okay, whatever. And so he comes to pick me up, and there's something wrong. And I'm going, Adam, what's wrong? They sent his buddies to Iraq that morning. He was supposed to go, but he didn't have to go. He lucked out. This is the third time my son has lucked out. He didn't have to go to Afghanistan or Iraq twice. So he's pretty rattled because his buddies had to go the day before Thanksgiving. My thought was, why couldn't they leave those kids home to celebrate Thanksgiving with their families? What would 2 days have hurt? But there's something else wrong. One of the young men in his squadron decided not to go. So about a mile from where Adam picked me up, this young man took his life rather than go to Iraq and take the lives of others. And so I have 5 days with a son that is totally messed up. And I do what all good moms do. I spoil them and do all the things, you know. And I'm there and lots of hugs and kisses, making lots of cookies and taking him to lunch and everything. And I helped him do all kinds of things. On Thursday, we went up to a friend's house in Boise. And it was great because Adam relaxed and he was, little bits of my own Adam came back. Because he's not my Adam anymore. He's a brainwashed, redneck, military hick, and that's exactly what I tell him quite often. And he talked to some of my friends, and he was doing better. We went back home that night, and then Friday, he and I together went to Boise, and we hung out and did mom and son things and had a great time. And on Saturday, I went with him into the Senior Citizen Center at Mountain Home. And he's a Boy Scout leader down there. And one of the things he was doing was helping them decorate their Senior Citizen Center for Christmas. And then after we got through, we were going to lunch at Arby's. And we were there, and I was sitting across from him, and he was shaking. His hand was shaking so hard. It was just like this. I'm going, Adam, what's wrong? Are you that hungry? Because I know if he doesn't eat on time, he has troubles. And he said, no, Mom, you don't know who these people are. And I'm looking around Arby's. Arby's is full of a Senior Citizens tour group. The youngest person is maybe 70. I said, Adam, these are like grandparents. They're old people. He said, Mom, they're probably terrorists. You don't know who they are. And I'm going, Adam, we're in Mountain Home, Idaho. This is Podunk, Egypt. There's nothing here. You don't know, Mom. They could be out to get us. And I'm just going, what the world is going on? To see my son that scared at Mountain Home. In Boise, he wasn't scared the day before. He said, well, I got my jacket on, Mom. I said, it's the same jacket you wore yesterday, Mom. And I think the thing was, he was so close to base. He was afraid. He was afraid something would happen to him, to me. He was afraid this busload, this tour bus full of senior citizens were terrorists. And I got home, back to Palouse, and I was telling my younger son, Paul, what had happened. His response was, Mom, what the fuck have they done to my brother? That's not right. And I'm going, that's right, Paul. It's not. It's not right to scare my son. Some of the talks I've had with my son break my heart. They've taught him that those people aren't human. They aren't citizens. They aren't anything. And his comment was, Mom, if I think of them that way, if I have to shoot them and kill them, it's not so bad. If I don't have to see them fall, if I don't have to see their face dead, it's not so bad. But Mommy, if I have to kill them, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then what can I do? What do I say? How do I say, son? I can't say it's okay because it's not. He knows it's wrong. But he's in that military, like most of the young people, for an education. They go in because they don't have the dollars to go to school. That's why he went. He didn't want student loans. He wanted to go to school. He wanted an education. And so this is the way he chose. And now, I'm going to read this. He says, many young people go into the military to get an education, but Uncle Sam uses a bait and switch. Almost 66% of our military recruits never get any college funding, although they pay into the college fund. The military bestows benefits only on those who receive, now this is the key, fully honorable discharge. Those who receive a general discharge or discharged under honorable conditions do not qualify. It all depends on how they write the discharge. So these kids are going in, putting the money into the fund so they can go to school and are getting nothing, absolutely nothing. So what are we telling those kids? That your life is worthless? You don't need an education, you don't need anything. You fought and served, tried to protect our country, but we're going to pay you back with nothing? Is that right? I don't think so. The only other thing I have to say, the other Thursday night, I had the privilege of being part of a political poll. Normally I don't do those kind of things. But I decided, well, heck, I'll do it. And the first question they asked me was my opinion of the president and administration. My answer was exactly this: if that fucking son of a bitch kills my son, he will pay. And that's exactly my thoughts. If he kills my son, or my younger son has to go because they have a draft, he will pay. I don't know what I'll do, but I can't lose my sons. I think of all the mothers that had to lose their children, whether their sons or daughters, or their sons come home wounded, or their mind just comes home messed up. I can't imagine. I've almost lost both of my sons twice to illness, and I know how scary that was. But to lose him to something as stupid as this, I don't think I could deal with that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, I feel like I could touch on a lot of issues with that. I've been brainwashed. I've been a hick. I've been that American kid that didn't have any real economic support. You know, I'm not poor. I don't know what it means to be hungry. But I've been in that position. I needed to escape. I grew up in Pocatello, Idaho. What was the best way? I'd grown up on war and James Bond. Heck yeah, let's go to the military. I was disappointed. Here's a good one for you. I was disappointed that I was a year too young to be in the main combat of the first war in Iraq. So as I stand up here before you today and oppose this war, 10 years ago or so, I was disappointed because I didn't get to go fight. Somehow, I had been educated that way through my social conditioning to think that way. And I don't know how many vets go through that. I don't know what to, you know, how to even speak to that, but it's true. It's a type of brainwashing. And the only thing you can do is learn your way out of it. You know, the military was my education. They taught me what really goes on. The other thing I want to just bring up real quick is the suicide rates for this war. In America right now, the one anomaly we got on Vietnam is we got the suicide rates are higher. They're higher than they were for Vietnam. The kids are just killing themselves. And I'm not trying to say we're better or it's different than Vietnam, but early on in the stages, we're seeing these are some of the differences between Vietnam and this. And I know there's a lot of Vietnam vets here. And there's a lot of vets, period, because we're a nation of war. So next will be Dean Stewart, and he's going to speak on the anniversary of the war. And then we will follow up with Melinda, and she'll be talking about the Web of Lies a little bit, and we'll have a dance. And I'll probably have a few more comments. And the food's over there for anybody that's just showed up, doesn't know about it. I don't know where it's at or what's left. I haven't been over there, but it's still there. And thanks for everybody for hanging out. And we're still going. So here's Dean.
Before I start, Jerry asked me to remind everybody that there are postcards over here. The Palouse Peace Coalition has put out postcards so that you might be able to write to your congresspeople, your representatives, to let them know. The postcards are all ready for you. All you have to do is just write them out and send them away. So please do that. Please visit this booth right over here. I tried to come up with a statement that can somehow be respectful of this administration because I don't believe that the polarization serves anybody very well. But we were told again yesterday by our president that if we're not in total agreement with his battle plan, That if we're not in agreement with his unilateral demands on the rest of the world, then we are in fact his enemies. He says there is no neutral ground. Well, I don't choose to be an enemy of the president, but apparently he chooses to be mine and possibly your enemy too. Apparently the president has chosen to be an enemy of anybody who calls him or his administration to task on his lies and their lies being used over and over again to justify this war that he began with the bombing of Baghdad a year ago right now. This is George's anniversary. Of course, now that the president has once more declared that his critics are his enemies, we, folks like us, we're all the more obligated for the sake of our country, for the sake of our Constitution, for the sake of peace, for the sake of civility, we're all the more obligated to oppose this president's ongoing deceit and his maniacal objectives. We are morally and patriotically obligated to see that this president leaves the office that gives him such power. Now, we all know the world was not really in all that great a shape 3.5 years ago when the Supreme Court declared that Mr. Bush be the president. He was not elected. Counting votes at that time was determined to be too cumbersome and eventually to be unpatriotic. Beginning immediately from that pitiful moment in American history, things went from bad to very worse. We have a job to do, all who are friends of peace, friends of the Constitution, friends of the earth, friends of the world. We need, this is not easy, we need to evict the emperor. We also need to make sure that the next administration is one that earns and keeps the respect of people like you, people who are sick to death of lies and arrogance that justify whatever policies that happen to satisfy them. We have a long way to go. And I don't really know, maybe you happen to believe there is, but I don't know if there's any candidate right now that's convinced that it is safe enough to take a stand against this war. I don't know if there are any candidates who believe that it's safe enough. I don't believe that any of the leading candidates are right now. And I believe that's because we, who want a new president, we are still too unorganized. We are still a tad too shell-shocked at what's been happening. And we know that merely accusing and ranting is no way to bring down an emperor or to end a horrible war. I'm not against screaming and ranting. But if that's all that we do, we just make ourselves hoarse. I will be happy to scream and rant now, but we need to talk later. We need to work. We need to contribute. We need to pray. We need to vote. We need to be creative. We got to show those people who are still clinging to W's lies, and those are our friends, people. We need to show the people who are still clinging to W's lies that there is a better way. We have to make sure this anniversary in Baghdad is the last one. Don't just wait for peace. Work for peace till it comes.
Alright, don't mind me, I was having a roll here. Trying to calm down, I'm still nervous. Can you believe that? Alright, there was one other thing kind of added in here. Melinda Husky is going to speak next, and she's also going to help define the web of lies for everybody a little bit more. And she's also going to help introduce a dance that will be performed by Nick, was that right? Steve, sorry. By Steve, and I think he has some accompaniment folks. And it's a Martin Luther King dance, and Melinda will probably speak a lot more to that. And try and remind everybody about the booths. I see a great little thing over here for Rugrats to draw on. And there's Sidewalk Chalk. Peace Coalition has got their whole table set up. There's food. And whatever else for people to get involved with. I'm going to go ahead and bring up Melinda now, and she'll help carry us through towards the end.
How's that? Closer? How's that? Okay. Me and machines, it's kind of an uneasy relationship. I'm very honored to be here, and I'm so pleased to see that all of you have stayed here in a somewhat chilly wind, but it is the first day of spring. It is the first day of spring, and that's something to be really glad about. This has been a long winter, and it's been a long year, and we have lived in a kind of internal chill as well as an external chill. We have been chilled by terrible lies, lies about the way the world works, lies about the way our country works or ought to work, and lies about what's really happening in the world. And you've heard them all 273 of them, and I don't need to rehearse them for you here, because I want to send us out, as Jesus said, not with hopelessness, because there is a lot of hope. The fact that we're here is hope. And so I'm going to encourage Lori to come up with her scissors, and anybody else who has scissors, this is the web of lies. The lie that it was Iraq who caused those horrible, horrible deaths on September 11th. The lie that Iraq threatened the United States in any meaningful way. The lie that there was yellow cake uranium being transformed miraculously into bombs that would be put on little model airplane drones and dropped in Philadelphia and New York and Chicago and San Francisco and anywhere else in the United States. Those were all lies. Keep cutting, Lori. 273 cuts at the minimum. At the minimum. Those were lies. But we can stop believing them. We can speak against them, and we can begin to make peace. I want to remember, though, as we begin to think about making peace, that 3,300 U.S. citizens and citizens of the world in Iraq have been wounded to date in that war. Between 8,000 and 10,000 Iraqi people have been killed, people of all ages, people in all states of health, people in every walk of life, and we're not even counting them. Our government has said their lives are not worth counting. We're liberating them, but we don't care if they die in the process. What's wrong with that? 10,000 people dead, and we don't care enough to know their names and count them as losses in this war. 437 American and European soldiers have been killed since May 1st. We know their names. We know that they came from Poland, from Denmark, from Spain, from Italy, from the Ukraine, from Bulgaria, from Thailand, and from Estonia. And we mourn each and every one of those people. Those dead, those wounded, and those whose lives have simply been torn apart by the horror of a war that we didn't want. So what can we do? We can pay attention. We cannot turn on the television when we want to know what's happening in the world. We can read the newspaper. And not just the American newspapers. Read Canadian papers. Read British papers. Certain British papers. My money goes on The Guardian. Don't look for the page three girls. We can listen to radio that comes from other places, and we need to do that because we need to know in our hearts what the rest of the world thinks of us. It's a little harder to walk with that swagger down Main Street when you know what they're saying about us everywhere else in the world. We need to hear that. We can stay in touch, close personal touch with our representatives in Washington. I like to think that someday Butch Otter's going to give me his fraternity pin. We're going steady over the news, over the phone lines, over fax, over email, Butch and I. Esto perpetua, he signs every one of his letters to me. And I get a little thrill every time I see his name in my mailbox. But you too can go steady with Butch, or with Larry, or with any of our representatives, and I encourage you to do so. Make them work for you, even if you didn't vote for them. And more importantly, get involved in the upcoming election. Work, give money, spend time on the phones, do that awful, awful thing of going door to door. It's horrible, it's painful, it's embarrassing. If you're shy, it's torture. But it's not worse than what we're living through right now. Choose a peace organization to stay involved with. Don't just do it now or this week, but forever. And I'm going to put a plug in here for mine, the one I love that's dear to my heart, Afghans for Afghans. Since December of 2001, we have been knitting and crocheting Afghans, hats, mittens, sweaters, gloves, and sending them through the American Friends Service Committee to Kabul, where they're distributed to men, women, and children who are without even the most basic ways of keeping themselves sheltered from the bitter cold of Afghanistan. It was the least we could do after we bombed them. You know, we treat our friends, I think, worse than we treat our enemies. Remember, Afghanistan was our friend too, so we bombed them. But we can at least go back and try and keep them warm. Choose an organization and stay with them for the long term. And keep doing the small, ordinary, daily jobs that keep our world a little bit safer. Build peace and justice at home. There's lots to do right here in Moscow, in Pullman, in Palouse, in Troy, in Derry, and we need to be paying attention at home as well. If there's one thing Americans could maybe do a little less of, it's minding other people's business and minding our own a little more. And finally, I want to say that we need to take care of ourselves. When we are fragmented, exhausted, and filled with guilt, we have very little to give anyone. Choose your work carefully, intentionally, and wisely. We can each only do a little bit. I want to read a poem by Mary Oliver. I think I've heard more poetry today at this demonstration than I have in weeks, and it's a wonderful thing. I was an English major once, so this just brings joy to my heart. This is a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Wage Peace. Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in firemen and rubble. Breathe out whole buildings and flocks of red-winged blackbirds. Breathe in terrorists and breathe out sleeping children and freshly mown fields. Breathe in confusion and breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen and breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening. Hearing sirens, pray loud. Remember your tools, flower seeds, clothespins, clean rivers. Make soup, play music, learn the word for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit and make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the outbreath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice has already arrived. Don't wait another minute. Thank you so much.